Welcome to the Second Thought Podcast. For show notes, for links and transcripts, please visit secondthoughtfortheday.com. First, you have my apologies. The last few weeks have distracted me from this project. My mother died, which was not unexpected, but still very sad. It resulted in a lot of writing, but none in the form of critical commentary of the BBC. I imagine the event will produce inspiration for Second Thought, not least because my atheist brother and I needed to find a way to celebrate that part of my mother's life that was religious. That to come. For now, we will be picking up where we left off on the topics of faith and doubt, as prompted by a Thought for the Day broadcast on the 24th of April, 2025, from Cheney MacDonald. MacDonald was introduced as a Christian commentator. She was formerly head of fundraising and engagement at Christian Aid, and today she leads a thing called Theos, which describes itself as a Christian think tank. Well, almost. With an interesting approach to specificity, it actually describes itself as a Christian religion and society think tank. This Theos tank of thought must truly be vast if they're able to spread it so widely, or perhaps they already have, accounting for the observations to come. According to its website, Theos believes that religion is a significant force in public life and that it should have an active role, therefore, in public debate. There is, I think, a lot wrong there. First, there's the implication that any entity deserves a role in public debate, and that there's some automatic invitation to join resulting from force in public life. Anyone with something relevant and valuable to contribute can take an active role in public debate. There is no permit for which you need apply. I've contributed to all-party parliamentary meetings and I've voiced my opinions in local government policy discussions, and if I can do it, I can't see what extrinsically might stop religions from doing the same. And that religion should have a role in public debate sounds to me like shrill protestation. This isn't an engagement achieved by protesting. It is achieved by doing. Unless, of course, this is all just very telling of something else. It makes me wonder if each time the Christians behind Theos attempted to partake in public debate, they were left feeling unheard. Now, the lesson from that is clear, and that lesson is not, we must go set up a think tank. Doesn't it sound a bit petulant? Like these Christians felt slighted, that their contributions were ignored, and instead of examining what might be wrong with those contributions, they just ordered a bigger loud hailer. And by stressing a position of religion being a significant force in public life, it seems to me that Theos is either acting in bad faith or it's been at the Kool-Aid, and neither is a good look for a religious organisation. For anyone not familiar with that connection, please Google Kool-Aid with a K, 1978, Jonestown. I don't think anyone can reasonably conclude that religion is a significant force in British public life today. I get a strong impression from the presenters of Thought for the Day that they struggle with the notion that they represent the extremes of British churchiness, or that the public life of churches should not be conflated with the public life of a country. Theos, despite the way it defines itself, is principally focused on Christianity. And I find the notion of Christianity as a significant force in public life to be laughable. Now, my view of Christianity in the UK, which I appreciate is not universally shared, is that for the most part it is a fossil. It is a clue to the tyrannical monster that it once was, but it's now best kept in museums and most definitely away from evangelical revivalists. Oh, and any improbable geneticists with a liking for amber. Like the monarchy, religion in the UK persists only because it's adopted a moderate and palatable form after quite rightly being enfeebled and sanitised by such things as education, the Enlightenment, evolution, and democracy. What we do have is cultural Christianity, as popularized by none other than Richard Dawkins. The church provides much-loved window dressing for marking life events and public holidays. It supplies for those who wish to indulge a timeless opportunity for hymn singing, bell ringing, jumble sales, the noble provision of civic support, and the drinking of tea. Oh, and community. I mean, let's not knock it. Mainstream Christianity has, though, long since abandoned the rabid threats of brimstone and perpetual torment in hell that can't be avoided just by being a good person, and it's only now the radical fringes that cling to things like six-day creationism, special born-again passes to heaven, and the stoning of homosexuals. Back to Theos. Whether or not Christianity should or should not be considered a force in public life, Theos strikes me as an entirely unserious organization, or one that is so detached from reality that it maintains an unawareness of its own irrelevance. It will be interesting to revisit this assessment as we learn about Cheney MacDonald's views as put via this episode of Thought for the Day. MacDonald uses the death of a pope as a platform from which to explore doubt in the context of faith. Here's her opening.
I remember Pope Francis as the pope who wasn't afraid of doubt. Crises of faith are not failures against faith, he said. A faith without doubts cannot advance. This week, the church hears again the story of the disciple Thomas and his encounter with the risen Jesus. This very human moment, in which an angry Thomas says he needs some firm and hard evidence to believe in the resurrection, has even attached the word doubt to his name. But I think we're all doubting Thomas's, really.
I should bloody hope so. Accepting anything solely on the word of another has always been folly. And in a time when the technology of social media has democratized propaganda, maintaining a suitable degree of doubt is more valuable a life skill than ever. It is, though, a life skill, the underdevelopment of which can appear to correlate with belief in the implausible. In 2001, I was working at a firm in Blackfriars, and one of my peers was a charming and utterly decent person called Charlotte. She was, by her own billing, an evangelical born-again Christian. But she was a great colleague. She had good ideas. She worked hard. She knew how to manage clients, and she knew how to manage staff. She was, though, almost entirely without guile. On the 21st of September, the Friday of the week after the 9/11 attacks, Charlotte shared an email she'd received. The message asked the recipient to type into Microsoft Word the flight number of the aircraft that crashed into the ground before it could be flown by terrorists into buildings in Washington, D.C. This, I should mention, predated Facebook by 3 years, so email was back then how viral got done. Helpfully, this email provided the flight number, QN33, and then it invited the recipient to convert the text into the font Wingdings. Now, that's not really a font, it's just one of several collections of icons that shipped with Microsoft Office. And to Charlotte's horror and amazement, the resulting Wingding icons were of an aircraft, two towers, and a skull and crossbones. Unable to contain her astonishment, she hastened me round to see her screen. The ruse was obvious. I asked if she'd checked the flight numbers of the 9/11 hijacked planes. She had not. The astonishment, horror, and amazement were snuffed down by the simplest of searches on Google. She so wanted it to be true. She so wanted this mystical Microsoft made-up meme to have hinted at something beyond explanation, beyond natural. How odd. This craving for proof, like Catholics in their miracles, has always to me been bewildering. Religion, I thought, demanded faith. It demanded belief without evidence. If you have evidence, you lose the need for faith. And what point then is religion? A suitable time, I think, to revisit Douglas Adams and the Babelfish.
The Babelfish is small, yellow, leech-like, and probably the oddest thing in the universe. It feeds on brainwave energy, absorbing all unconscious frequencies and then excreting telepathically a matrix formed from the conscious frequencies and nerve signals picked up from the speech centers of the brain. The practical upshot of which is that if you stick one in your ear, you can instantly understand anything said to you in any form of language. The speech you hear decodes the brainwave matrix. Now, it is such a bizarrely improbable coincidence that anything so mind-bogglingly useful could evolve purely by chance that some thinkers have chosen to see it as a final clinching proof of the non-existence of God. The argument goes something like this. I refuse to prove that I exist, says God, for proof denies faith, and without faith I am nothing. But, said man, the Babel fish is a dead giveaway, isn't it? It proves you exist, and so therefore you don't. QED. Oh dear, says God, I hadn't thought of that, and promptly vanishes in a puff of logic.
This is obviously brilliant, and largely consistent with the comments about Tao that Cheney recounted from Pope Francis. If faith is essential for religion, then doubt is essential for faith, and if there were no doubt, there would be no need for faith. Prominent humanist scientists are often quick to praise the attempts of early thinkers to develop hypotheses to explain the world in which they found themselves. In the absence of better explanations, gods that cause fire, wind, and bad harvests are a good start. This only begins to present a problem when new observations are made, which result in both doubt and better explanations. Now, this sounds like an ideal, but when the new explanations are deliberately ignored, we get an intractable problem. Galileo famously was not just ignored, but silenced by the church, dying while under house arrest to prevent him from teaching knowledge of the sun being at the center of the known universe. Any search for understanding gets derailed when the importance of doubt is diminished. However good your hypothesis, it should only ever be considered a useful model until a better one is found. To cling on to ideas that are past their think-by date is, though, pretty human. Obsolete ideas embedded in the egos and reputations of powerful people can be hard to shake off. Embed them in a religion, though, and doubt gets dogmatically eliminated. Typically because the ideas arising out of doubt present a threat to the established holy order, and that's considered greater than the threat of continued ignorance. Shaking off becomes the work of millennia. Doubt is clearly essential for enlightenment and the progression of knowledge. It should also be good for religion. I mean, if you've committed already to a belief in a thing for which there's no evidence, doubt becomes a way to exercise your faith. If you don't feel doubt, then your belief could be absolute, requiring no faith. And if faith is considered to be the cornerstone of religion, then doubt is its essential precursor. Pope Francis and Chiney MacDonald, to me, seemed only to be exploring this critical relationship between religion, faith, doubt, and belief. Yet this approach among Christians on the respective roles of faith, reason, evidence, knowledge, and belief is apparently quite rare. I was happy to take Douglas Adams's treatment as definitive commentary on the matter. Alas, that state of happiness is shattered. It turns out that the roles of faith and reason is one of the murkiest and most shabbily debated subjects in Christian theology. It is a real cluster. There's deception, dishonesty, sleight of hand, needless charm offensive, belligerent hardliners, magical thinkers, impossible inventions, and a stunning lack of humility almost everywhere. Before getting into it, what does the Bible say about faith, I wonder? One very famous instance which Christians are taught is in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Now, the first of those phrases seems fair enough. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. Or at least fair enough until you begin to wonder what's meant by the word substance. Now, the quote just there was from the King James version of the Bible. There are several other versions, more recently, that replace substance with words like assurance, reality, and certainty. Faith is the certainty of things hoped for. Unless meant as a joke or a caution, that's genuinely meaningless. Moreover, it's a distortion of the apparent intended meaning. The earliest rendering we have today of the book of Hebrews is in Greek, and the word used for substance in Greek is hypostasis, which has a range of meanings dependent upon context. See how troublesome it is to pin your belief system on ancient scribblings? Hypostasis is most broadly understood in this philosophical context to mean the underlying reality of something, and this kind of works. Faith is the underlying reality of things hoped for. Although that's almost exactly like saying unreal is the underlying reality of things dreamed up, which is less poetic but far better at revealing the nature of the statement. The second phrase is a real humdinger. Faith is the evidence of things not seen. Gibberish. Unless, once again, it's being deployed as a warning or a caution in the vein of death is the wages of things ungodly. So in this case, faith, being the evidence of things unseen, warns against drawing any conclusions from things unseen because faith is evidence of nothing. In which case, Christians have long been up the wrong tree barking. Whatever, in this simple verse, we have the whole scope of a deep religious muddle. Now, given all the murky deceit, best start with some clear definitions, specifically the terms reason, faith, belief, knowledge, and evidence, as I'm using them now. They're plain words with plain meanings. However, because of the philosophy that's developed around knowledge, logic, and the theology of belief, we're given some very precise definitions that are useful to navigate this topic. Knowledge. So knowledge is what is held to be true in the light of evidence. Belief is what is held to be true without evidence. Faith is a motive to believe without the need for that evidence. And evidence is valid justification for the truth of knowledge. Reason is the use of logic to identify valid justification, to discern between belief and knowledge. Now, this isn't an attempt to fix the meaning, redefine, or deny other meanings of these words, just an academic exercise allowing precise common use of terms. Now, there'll always be some dipshit who thinks they're smart in attempting to subvert the intent by imposing a personal definition of valid or truth. Now, if you encounter one of those, toast their confidence and move on. Now, I should point out here that if you believe that the knowledge of gods is only possible through faith or through the revelation of a god as a consequence of your faith, you can skip most of this. For you, faith and reason are in conflict on matters of God. They are incompatible. There's no discussion to be had. We can move on, and I hope you liked the bit about the hitchhikers. You will, though, be the subject of much discussion later, so feel free to stick around. Who knows, you might like it. Back to the definitions. It helps to put them to work. English supermarkets claim to sell sugar packaged with 1 kilogram to a bag. Do I believe the claim? Do I know the claim to be true? Do I know that bags of sugar in English supermarkets labeled 1 kilogram actually contain 1 kilogram of sugar? Well, yeah, I've purchased the bags, I've measured the sugar, I've baked with it. My observations of the amount of sugar is consistent with the amount claimed on the packet, but I'm also aware there's a government network of trading standard officers, and they're charged with checking that what's claimed on the label matches what's inside. I have valid justification of the truth, evidence that a typical bag of sugar in an English supermarket will contain the 1 kilogram as indicated on the label. This information is therefore, for all practical purposes, knowledge, not just belief. I used reason to process the claim, my observations, existing knowledge to reach the valid justification of truth. Now, I've also read multiple academic studies and several books on the subject of ultra-processed food. It's claimed in several of these papers and books that ultra-processed food, UPF, is contributing to overweight and obesity, and the effect appears to be divorced from the amount of salt, sugar, and fat in the food. And it's perhaps related to ingredients that are not naturally part of human diet. Much is not understood, but one suggestion has it that the UPF somehow knocks out our normal homeostasis for energy. That is, we carry on eating food when for thousands of years, the normal feedback loops, like feeling full, kicked in to stop us eating before we ate more than was good for us. Now, I believe this homeostasis model is likely correct, and the mechanism may be mediated by the gut microbiome. We have observations, we have suggestions that might plausibly explain those observations, and many of those are currently not within the realm of knowledge. I, however, choose to believe that ultra-processed food is causative for overweight and obesity. I cannot, though, reason my way to knowledge that every food under that academic definition of UPF has any effect on weight. I can't even reason my way to belief for either of the ingredient or the homeostasis hypotheses. I merely suspect they're right. Time and research will tell. So what are the various realms of understanding among Christians on the relative positions and merits of faith and reason? All of them fall in broadly to one of two camps, tension or harmony. Tension when they are considered to be incompatible ideas, especially with respect to the search of knowledge for God. Or they're in harmony. Reason and faith in some way are thought to complement one another in the search for knowledge of the divine. And along this spectrum of tension and harmony, we find the multiple theological offerings from various bits of various Christian traditions. In practice, though, there are three groups of modern Christians. First, we have the straightforward faith absolutists. For them, it is only through faith that you can know God. Then we have the disguised faith absolutists. Oh, reason has its place, but it's only through faith that you can know God. And then we have the reason absolutist. We have proof of God through reason. We don't need faith, at least not in the way you've defined it here. Now, I should point out that these are my categories. Unsurprisingly, those Christians in the group I've labeled disguised faith absolutists don't see themselves in quite this light. More commonly, they're referred to according to what subgroup they're in on the tension harmony continuum as synthesists or harmonists or presuppositionists. Some of these make great play of reason being able to work in harmony with faith. Some even suggest that the two essentially complement one another. This, though, is all PR. As different splinters of the church contort themselves in attempts to head off criticism and combat their own irrelevance and mask their innate intolerance, ultimately, the disguised faith absolutists all end up with the same subordination of reason to faith via one MacGuffin or another. Now, in fairness, one of the disguisers is much more honest about this disguise than the others. The traditional labels for these groups are fideism, which I've almost certainly not pronounced correctly, which is those that agree faith is all. Reason is subordinate to and the servant of faith. Reason is often regarded with suspicion. And for me, they're the straightforward faith absolutists. We then have the Thomist synthesists. From Thomas Aquinas and other Catholic thinkers, faith and reason can coexist as friends. Faith, though, perfects reason. Faith isn't irrational, it is suprarational. Revelation of God via faith is the only way to have knowledge of constructs such as the Trinity and incarnation. Thus, there is an invention of a whole new category of knowledge, only accessible via faith. And thus is created a hierarchy of truths. These are guys in the disguised faith absolutism camp. Then we have presuppositionalism. Bear with. From Calvin and other Protestant thinkers, reason is of man, and hence it is blinded by sin. These guys have no neutrality. Christianity is the sole valid foundation for morality, reason, and meaning. The Bible is presupposed to be infallible, and only then is reason considered of value. Still, disguised faith, absolutism. There's also the transrationalists from Byzantine Eastern Orthodoxy. Faith transcends but does not contradict reason. Reason cannot fully comprehend God, and there's an assertion that God is beyond categorization. This is just supra-rationalism, but with added mysticism and presuppositional-like rejection of the categorizations of knowledge. For me, plain old, disguised, faith, absolutism. And then finally, evidentialism. It's possible to know God through reason alone. No need for faith or belief. And this gives us the modern apologetics. We have evidence, valid justifications of the truth, for the existence of God, achieved only by reason, who I've rather politely called reason absolutists. So, of these three, the first and the last are on the fringes. Faith absolutists are dismissed by the Catholic Church as superstitious, which never stops being funny. Reason absolutists are similarly fringe. They're obliged to maintain that they have incontrovertible objective evidence for the existence of God, while the rest of the world quite rightly regards them as simpletons. We'll expand on the contradictions and the bad faith of the apologists shortly. Mainstreamers, though, are almost all in a different uncomfortable compromise, that of disguised absolutism. It's a fudge. It's a fudge that allows them to seem slightly less backward and less irrelevant. As recently as 1998, a thing called a papal encyclical was published by Pope John Paul II as official teaching of the Roman Catholic Church on matters of faith and reason. It was called Fides et Ratio. Again, Latin's not my thing. There's probably a way to pronounce that. It is advanced as a harmonious approach for all of Catholicism. Reason and faith could not only coexist, but they complemented one another. The broad summary was that faith without reason leads to superstition, and that reason without faith leads to nihilism. Oh yes, when you're on the inside of Catholicism, it's other things that look superstitious. In truth, this was disingenuous claptrap. A strategic move to head off criticism and to prevent the Church from direct and unwinnable confrontation with an age of reason in a fast-developing world that was failing to see any relevance of the Church in the advancement of humanity. Worse, the dogma of the Catholic Church was increasingly seen as a drag on progress. For example, the Church has long since refused to tolerate sex that wasn't between married heterosexual couples and then never for anything but baby production. Sounds almost quaint. Until you realise that this teaching is not only homophobic, but that it killed hundreds of thousands of people by undermining the use of condoms as one of the most effective ways to prevent people from dying of AIDS across Africa. For all of its talk of harmony, the encyclical had buried within it the concept of ultimate truth, a concept where only faith has relevance and reason falls away, no matter how helpful it had been up to that point. This is special pleading. The Church pronounces faith to be of exclusive merit when seeking knowledge of God, and it creates a special new category of knowledge and hence places God conveniently beyond reason. The harmony vanishes. These guys are faith absolutists. It's like the colour Velabreath. It's half violet and half yellow with a tinge of echo breath. It's common throughout nature, but it's only visible if you genuinely believe in yellow breath. Once unfettered by inquiry, reason, and science, and only then, it becomes visible to those select few who truly believe. In other words, codswallop. Having invented gods, it becomes necessary to invent ways of putting gods beyond reason. Allow the two to collide, and you will skewer dogma with ruthless inevitability and velabreath. The other large component among the mainstream disguised faith absolutists are the presuppositionalists. From a Protestant tradition, they simply hold that the Bible is presupposed to be true. Art for that there. Fine with you using reason to your heart's content. This is the same as saying the Bible is true because it says it's true. It also seeks, just as the Catholic ultimate truth, to put the existence of God beyond what can be debated. One's a circular argument and apparently evidence that the presuppositionists don't really care if you have criticism of their logic, and the other is special pleading to put arbitrary rein on inquiry. Same rubbish, different Christians. Both illustrate the truth of faith absolutism, that it has no place for reason, which can only be a threat. yet they maintain their acceptable public faces by stressing that reason and faith are compatible and that church is tolerant and inclusive. They know this to be false and they seek to deceive us in their own interests regardless. So we've got the faith absolutists and we've got the faith absolutists who pretend that they're not. And then there's a final group, relatively common among modern Christians. These are the reason absolutists who claim that they can prove the existence of God. They have a passion for giving bad ideas very important sounding names. For example, they call their approach apologetics, and it will go downhill from here on that front. And it's for these I hold the most contempt. They go along with faith, but they devote themselves to concocting, repackaging, and disseminating evidence that denies any need for faith. These are the crowd who would desperately attempt a Babel fish breeding program and then watch God disappear in a cloud of logic, not quite realizing what they'd done, much to the entertainment of all of us. I remember being told as a teenager by one of my teachers that one should never enter into a shouting match with an idiot in the street. No advantage will come from it, and no onlooker will be able to discern which of the two of you is the idiot. On the same grounds, be wary of engaging any of these Christians in debate. They all meddle with the ground rules to advance their rules. They have nothing to lose and all to gain. Hence, no issue with the shouting match. And for them, 50-50 are good odds for not being mistaken as the idiot. And it's from the apologetic harbour for absurdity that we get such things as intelligent design, which is an important sounding name for creationism. We get fine-tuning, which is an important sounding name for failure to understand observer bias. And then there's a genuinely batty argument about the inevitability of there being a God simply because other things exist. I'm not kidding. Those with a finger on the pulse of apologetics claim that if a thing exists, then it must have had a beginning. And that if a thing had a beginning, there must be a God. That, on its own merits, is a monument to the colossally daft. If, though, you ask them about the beginnings of God, they claim you're being unfair, and that gods do not have beginnings like other things. This idea was presumably so, shall we say, bold, that a run-of-the-mill important-sounding name wasn't going to cut it. The one they came up with was the Kalem cosmological argument. You couldn't make this up. My children are familiar with the maxim that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. It would appear that, to an apologist, the acceptance of extraordinary claims is dependent only upon the suitable invention of an extraordinary name. Oddly, this group of reason absolutists are utterly wedded to faith. They've shifted targets, likely without awareness, but they now hold that intelligent design, fine-tuning, and the Kalem cosmological argument are true, despite no valid argument in support of those truths. By necessity of their own argument, they now have to believe that manifestly false things are true to secure their need to reason the existence of God. Colossally daft, justice to this collection of absolutists does not do. Google apologetics, and you'll find a fixed litany of scripture that's repeatedly regurgitated in support. No surprise, we find here more willful deceit and more abandonment of sense. Typically, an apologist will claim that the Bible commands them to defend their religion with reason. Now, it's worth touching on this as it reveals dishonesty from the outset. For example, the word reason appears in the King James translation of the book of Isaiah, chapter 1, verse 18. Come now, let us reason together, saith the Lord. You'll find this text cited over and over by apologists who claim this verse to be a commandment from God for humankind to employ reason, in the sense of using intellect and logic, to defend their belief in and knowledge of God. I'm guessing they figure no one will actually check the sources. When you do, you begin to find problems. The Hebrew word that is translated to reason in that verse, in the original Isaiah, has the root yakah, which can mean many things according to context. It can mean to determine, to argue, to rebuke, to mediate, and to reconcile. The meaning to argue could reasonably translate it as to reason. The scene, though, in the first chapter of Isaiah, is a courtroom. Judah is charged with scarlet sins by none other than God. Talk about judge, jury, and executioner. God's not suggesting they reason or debate the matter at hand. He's done with that. It'd be nonsense in this context. He's inviting reconciliation and resolution before offering forgiveness. A more recent popular English translation of the Bible, the New International Version, contains this same verse as, "Come now, let us settle the matter, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Though as red as crimson, they shall be like wool." At one stroke of curiosity, a large and clumsy deceit is removed from the arsenal of those who would mislead you with evangelical propaganda. These godly folk default to dishonesty with alarming speed when they believe deceit will strengthen their case. They are, as a waiter in the film Pretty Woman might put it, slippery little suckers. Apologetics, though, is far more cynical than I've made it seem. In the 1980s, they put together intelligent design to counter the impact that evolution was having on the teaching of biology in American high schools. When you hear them discuss it, you'll note they never identify the designer in intelligent design. But it's obviously the Christian God. Why the distance? Because the whole project was an attempt to have schools teach creationism. It was a cause that was ultimately lost in the courts, which were not about to entertain such blatant deceit or such affront to the First Amendment to the American Constitution. There is one other group of reason absolutists, the atheists. Without any evidence for God or any reason to invent a God, they don't. This might be one of the most powerful illustrations of Occam's razor. We'll have to cover this and other logical razors another day. By way of contrast, faith, evidence, and belief for an atheist are much more straightforward. Most atheists are also agnostic. This is a simple acknowledgement that no one can be certain that there is a God. The phrase absence of evidence is not evidence of absence is somewhat commonplace. It's famously attributed to the scientist Carl Sagan. By the same token, I'm agnostic about the existence of fairies and dragons and magic. While it seems enormously unlikely that there are any winged sprites in my garden or fire-breathing lizards in Welsh steam engines, I can't prove they don't exist. Oh, if you weren't aware of the interplay between dragons and Welsh steam engines, please check out Ivor the Engine, I'm sure it's on YouTube, for a beautiful take on the mythology. Atheists, when confronted with a staggering lack of evidence for gods, simply put them in the same category as magic beans, magic carpets, and wish-granting genies. That choice, though, demonstrates a belief. Now, it's highly implausible to me that some elephant-sized reptile can spit flames whilst being a master of aerobatics. I choose to believe they're nothing more than figments of the human imagination. This imagination, though, is very good at figments. From the record of human history to which we today have access, there is evidence of 3,000 gods having been claimed at one time or another to have existed, roughly. Clearly, humans have something of a talent for inventing and believing in them. Most Muslims, Jews, and Christians today have reached the conclusion that 2,999 of these gods, roughly, can be lumped in with dragons and Zeus and gremlins. And as Neil deGrasse Tyson, Richard Dawkins, and Ricky Gervais have so eloquently put it on many occasions, Christians, Jews, and Muslims have already done most of the work of atheists. In each case, they choose not to believe in almost all the gods. Atheists just choose to believe in one fewer god in each case. Put more directly, I believe there are no gods. This is clearly a belief as I have no way of knowing that they don't exist. But given all the opportunities that they've had to demonstrate they do, it seems entirely reasonable to conclude that the lack of evidence for gods for now is best explained by a lack of gods. Similarly, I believe in the germ theory of disease. I believe that planet Earth is a globe, and I believe in the theory of gravity and the theory of evolution. Do I know these things? Well, not really. I know that water is a liquid, and I know that water becomes a solid when sufficiently cold. I've got everyday experience that presents me with empirical evidence that causes knowledge in these cases to displace belief. An astronaut on the ISS would be able to do the same for the non-flat nature of the Earth, although in fairness, There are many ways to achieve that knowledge without having to enter low Earth orbit. For evolution, germ theory, and gravity, we all have to examine the observations made, how well they fit with the suggested explanations, and to consider the rigor to which these suggestions have already been subject. We each then have a choice to believe or not. On which note, back to MacDonald.
I've been a Christian my whole life, devoted much of my career to writing and thinking and speaking about God. But there are moments when I'm not sure God exists. Yes, I feel a sense of devotion to God, observe rituals, praise and worship God, feel a sense of wonder and beauty and transcendence, just like other believers. But it's funny how we're called that, believers, when belief is just one element in the experience of faith. Sometimes we might wonder, is anybody really there?
Funny? Is she joking? And what in Odin's name do you imagine she meant by belief being just an element of faith? Sure, she's using the word faith interchangeably for religion, but that's not the problem. There are lots of things, including those she listed, that stand alongside belief in the practice of religion, devotion, praise, worship, ritual, communion. To suggest that belief is in some way not the defining part, though, would be ridiculous. None of the remaining elements has any meaning if belief is absent. So no, not funny. Not funny at all. Perfectly sensible. This is a group of people who make a very public point of claiming knowledge of something for which they have no evidence. A group of people making a public display of belief. What would she have us call them? The worshippers, the praisers, the devoted, the pew warmers, the spirit stalkers, the fan club? She can moan all she wants, but much like nicknames, this isn't a choice she gets to make. Whining about what nickname others give you does not genuinely reveal good character. MacDonald should remain grateful we don't call them something else, like the reason deniers, the magical thinkers, the enlightenment dodgers, the blinded or the entrenched. She is also being dishonest. Belief is obviously not just an element of faith. It is the defining element, particularly when part of a discussion of doubt. It seems that Cheney MacDonald is every bit as unserious as the think tank she leads. While she casually invokes doubt and mocks the idea that Christians are believers, she also implies that some general component of Christianity is afraid of doubt. And she's right. The pretenders, the disguised faith absolutists, those Catholics and those presuppositionalists are clearly afraid that doubt leads to reason and that reason will then skewer faith. This is what makes Francis had to say so refreshing. He preached this lack of fear. He was also being considerably more honest than JP2. Francis was careful not to contradict Fides et Ratio, but he applied a logically coherent approach that is consistent with faith as the fuel for religion of which doubt provides an endless supply, and hence should be treasured, perhaps, not feared. That being the case, Christians should be seeking doubt wherever they can find it, secure in the knowledge that the greater the doubt, the stronger the faith, and the more robust the religion. If they were really behind this notion, archbishops in debates with Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins would have noted only and calmly that faith is the evidence of things unseen. There'd be no need to engage detractors on subjects such as dinosaurs or misogyny or how it's not possible to contain two pairs of 8 million species of animal on a boat. Especially at a time when a good 95% of those species are unknown to boat builders. These points would only serve as a valuable addition to the canon of doubt from which faith draws its power. But this, of course, is not how the church behaves. Not before Francis, and not now. In 2009, Hitchens was joined by Stephen Fry in a debate with two apparent luminaries of the Catholic Church, Anne Widdecombe, a former MP, and Archbishop John Anna Yakin. The debate was staged by Intelligence Squared, a reputable institution that employs live debate to encourage dispassionate critical thinking and to promote the importance of meaningful public discourse. The motion was that the Catholic Church is a force for good. Stephen and Christopher did a masterful job of dismantling the arguments in support of the motion. By engaging in the event, though, the Church demonstrated how invested it was in being perceived as a force for good. It was not happy to see the doubt invoked by Fry and Hitchens. Unless it was a strategic masterstroke. The Vatican knew that Widdicombe and Onayekin would founder. They knew that Fry and Hitchens would not only triumph, but they would eviscerate the arguments of the Catholic Church. Cardinals would then watch with glee at the 6 million YouTube views of the debate and reports of it in media around the globe. All this safe in the knowledge that doubt would be provoked, faith would be reinforced, and the Church emboldened. Hanlon's Razor states that one should not attribute to malice what can adequately be explained by incompetence. Similarly, one should not attribute to conspiracy what can adequately by incompetence also be explained. It seems very unlikely to me that the Catholic Church really is on a global mission to provoke doubt. I suspect, though, Dan Brown could get a book or two out of the idea, and in one of them, it would be revealed that the global sexual abuse scandal at the Catholic Church was all part of a centuries-old, cold and sinister plot to hijack doubt as the nuclear option to achieve Roman domination of all churches. MacDonald, though, was not happy just to provide us with faintly ridiculous comments that inescapably expose the impossible tightrope on which her church aims to walk with regard to faith and to reason. She went on to give us a live example of just how eager she is to believe the implausible. I suspect this journey also began with an email. On the 7th of April, 2025, an organization called the Bible Society published a report called A Quiet Revival, and it contained results of a YouGov survey into British church-going habits. The Bible Society is a non-profit that works to distribute and encourage the reading of the Christian Bible. Here's MacDonald.
Over the past week, there's been much discussion of new data from Bible Society and its YouGov poll, which shows an increase in church-going, particularly among younger people. Some have debated whether those arriving at church doors really believe or are just looking for belonging. I'm not sure the distinction between the two is that clear.
MacDonald queries the motives of the apparent new churchgoers, but accepts without flinch a conclusion from this survey that flies in the face of sense and all other evidence. And given what she does for a living, evidence with which she would be very familiar. We can all be grateful that whenever odd-sounding survey data are covered by the UK news media, there is a strong likelihood that these data will fall to the scrutiny of More or Less, an excellent BBC radio show that exists only to police the unbiased use of numbers in the news.
The survey apparently showed that church-going had dramatically increased between 2018, a previous survey, and 2024, from 8% of people going each week then to 12% now. Or, as one Christian publication put it,
church attendance soars 50% as faith surges among British youth.
That would be quite the turnaround, as both Christian belief and church-going have been in long-term decline for decades. But while resurrections are firmly on brand for Christians, not everyone is convinced.
The first move of More or Less was to note that this was a survey not of those who went to church, but of those who claimed they go to church.
It's well established that people don't actually go to church as much as they say they go to church. Research from the US using cell phone data suggests that while 30% of people say they go to church every month, only 20% actually do.
Then there were issues with just how big a return to church was actually being claimed.
Okay, take this summary from the Bible Society's website.
In 2018, just 4% of 18 to 24-year-olds said that they attended church at least monthly. Today, this has risen to 16%. with young men increasing from 4% to 21% and young women from 3% to 12%.
So in a few short years, the proportion of young women attending church has quadrupled and young men has quintupled. I mean, that is huge.
Yes, it is. So, what to do?
Well, look, when you get a survey result like this that goes against what you'd expect, you'd ideally want some more evidence.
As you might expect, more or less sought expert guidance. And in this case, from David Voss, an emeritus professor in social science from University College London, who noted that the Bible Society survey results are completely contradicted by other surveys.
Gold standard surveys such as the British Social Attitudes Survey show that church going has actually fallen by nearly a quarter between 2018 and post-pandemic. And very importantly, the main Christian denominations conduct and publish their own attendance counts every year. And those show that while church going has rebounded from the lows of the COVID lockdown, it remains substantially lower than it was in 2019 before the pandemic.
Yep, you heard that right.
Wait, so the churches themselves aren't reporting increases in attendance?
Not above pre-pandemic levels, no. For example, the Bible Society survey finds attendance among Catholics has doubled, but the Catholic Church itself says attendance is down since 2018.
As more or less then noted.
Well, this sounds like a pretty open and shut case. I don't think I'm being devil's advocate to say that I'm starting to doubt the figures in the Bible Society report. And there's enough evidence to suggest that it might just be a rogue survey result. They do happen. Maybe it's better to wait for more evidence?
They went on to note that a case could be made that the problem was not with this survey, but with the previous one that was used in the comparison. It's possible that the new data will provide interesting insights into the way the church attendance is beginning to approach pre-pandemic levels. But more or less, also noted,
we need to see the 2024 data for the Social Attitude Survey to check that theory, though.
I think it would be odd to call that a revival, though. And it does feel a bit like we're looking for arguments to fit the evidence. And there's nothing absolutely concrete that backs up this idea of a big increase in actual church attendance compared to before the pandemic.
No.
Did that stop Cheney and many other church-aligned sources and spokespeople from leading with headlines that simply claimed a new survey showed an increase in church-going? No, it did not. Most of us have worked out that when something looks too good to be true, there's a very good reason. The faithful, however, appear to be wired differently. They can't wait to believe things that are too good to be true. And on those grounds alone, it is easy to see why they struggle to make any meaningful contribution to public debate. Thank you for listening to the Second Thought podcast. For details of who we are, what we do, and why, please visit secondthoughtfortheday.com.